on the Bookshelf with your host, Dave.
So for
Duck
today,
Kirby.
Memorial Day weekend, we've got a special program, as we always like to do. All these 32 years that the show's been on the air, I've always had a special program for Memorial Day. We're talking today to Jean Batie, who is the author of Unsung Patriots, African Americans in America's Wars, from Stackpole Books. Jean served 20 years in the U.S. Army as a military intelligence analyst and linguist, received a doctorate from Georgetown University, and has written books about the Civil War and African American history, served as docent at Belgrove Plantation, and volunteered at Cedar Creek National Battlefield Park. And we are delighted to welcome him today to On the Bookshelf. How did you first get interested in this particular aspect of American military history?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm retired Army. I'm back second generation. I got into writing when I was a docent at Belgrove. My interests, I suddenly realized that my fascination with the Civil War and its battles was one thing, but what happened after the Civil War was tremendously more important. So I set about to find myself a book and read up on it. And I really couldn't find a book about it. I mean, there are some about parts of it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, not being a shy individual, I said, well, I'm going to write that book. Now, the first two books I wrote were a quarter-inch thick. This is somewhat over an inch thick book. So,
right.
There's a lot more detail in this. My third book was Collective Amnesia, American Apartheid, African Americans 400 Years in North America, 1619 to 2019. But I got good and bad criticism. One of my, actually a longtime friend, gave me 2 stars and said I hadn't covered a lot of information in that book. That upset me, of course. But then I looked into it. By dang, he was right. There was a lot of stuff. I said about correcting that deficiency, and I ended up with a 700-page book. That's a tome. And I have discovered in my process that, unfortunately, most of my compatriots are not as enthusiastic about history as I am. One is not taught. I mean, they're like I was. I just thought history was a batch of dates and boring stuff back in the eons ago when I was in school. But it's ever so much more. It's tracing the path of where we've been, and you can pretty much see where the path's going to go. And no one's particularly ever heard of Eugene Batie. If my name had name recognition, it would be a lot easier to sell books. But anyway, I persevere. In the process, Sackville said, well, we like your book, too. So I had 2, and they were the better fit. I mean, they're a much bigger name. They price their books much more reasonably, which is a big deal. If few people read history, who wants to pay $40, $45 or more for a book?
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah. Not happening. So I went with Stackpole because I've read lots of their books, and I know they're a fine military publishing house, and I considered myself lucky and privileged, and that in fact, I might end up being a little better known as a result of this book. That's not my objective, but since I do have 2 other books in my already written in my hopper.
You know, the great thing is Stackpole Books, I first ran into them probably 25 years or so ago and reviewed for them for a while. But what happens a lot of times with publishers is when they change publicists, the ones that leave take their list of connections with them and don't leave it for the person that takes over after they leave. So somebody new comes in, they don't know me from anywhere, even though I had reviewed 100 titles or so for them. They didn't remember me, and so when I asked about getting new volumes, they said, well, you know, you're not that big a deal, so we'll think about it. And that was where it lasted until recently. And now that Globe Pequo has taken over Stackpole Books and in distributing them, I think they're much better publicized and much better promoted now because they've got a bigger publisher house that is promoting them. Stackpole's got 90 years history of publishing titles in outdoors and crafts and military history, and especially Civil War history and World War II history. So that means that your book, Unsung Patriots, is a perfect fit for them.
Yes, so, it is. But I have great trust. What's meant to be is going to happen. And it's good. It's a good book. My book has 80 illustrations, and I am a disciple of Confucius. One picture worth a thousand words.
It puts a literal face on the names that you're reading, too. And particularly since a lot of the people that about whom you are writing in this particular book may not be very well known to the public, which is why the title Unsung Patriots, that makes it, I think, even more particular that we have a chance to see what they looked like. And there weren't always pictures kept of African-American warriors in our history, our combined history as Americans. And so it's really nice to see some faces to the names that you talk about in your book.
A great example is Charles Young. Probably none of your readers ever heard of this man. He was the third black African-American graduate of West Point. He served around 20 years with the 9th and 10th Cavalry. After the Civil War, because the U.S. colored troops, there had been 209,000 of them in 175 regiments, had performed so in such an outstanding manner, Congress authorized 6 regiments at first in 1866, but in 1899, I think the Democrats got in and had the budget cut back, not just for the black troops, but across the board for all troops, the white troops included. So it ends up being 2 black cavalry regiments and 2 black infantry regiments. So this Charles Young served 20 years. He rose to full colonel. This is an incredible feat for a black man. I mean, we don't understand how thick the prejudice was, bigotry was back then. But there's the picture of him in the book. You just see he is every inch a soldier's soldier.
Yeah,
I would go anywhere with that man. So what they did to him is 1917 in World War I, we're cranking up for that. They medically retired him because they were afraid he would command some white soldiers.
Oh, right,
In fact, he already had a white lieutenant from Georgia, I think it was, who had complained about having to respond to the orders of a black man. I mean, how sad is that? And by the way, as a little footnote, was it last year or the year before, the Secretary of Army posthumously promoted him to Brigadier General, at least, you know?
Yeah, it certainly took a while.
Probably deserved more than that, but anyway, a lot of things. Some of them made me cry.
Yeah. His story really isn't that much of an anomaly either.
No, it's not.
One of the things that you bring forth in the book is that in every war that America's fought, there have been black soldiers, sailors, Marines, who have been a part of the action and have done well in combat. And yet, the next war would come along and the powers that be would say, well, we don't know if we can trust black soldiers after all. What if they cut and run? Ignoring the fact that, well, the last time you had a war and they were invited to play, they did real well. So why should this bunch be different than the last bunch? Why should we expect them not to be as courageous as their fathers or their grandfathers were in the previous wars in which they were involved? Probably people know about black soldiers during the Civil War because of movies like
Glory,
you know, which is a terrific movie. They have to consolidate history a little bit and you know, create characters to fill them out and everything, but it's essentially the truth. And these guys were treated with disdain by the Union Army. They had broken weapons or no weapons at all. They had worn out uniforms. They didn't get paid as much as the black privates didn't make as much as a white private was, and that wasn't very much. They were given the crummiest assignments, and it seemed like, even though the Confederate Army, of course, was not enthralled by fighting against black warriors, but the Union Army didn't seem really all that happy about it, at least at first. And later on, the sentiment seemed to be often, well, if somebody's got to die in a war, at least it's going to be them and not me.
They earned most soldiers in blues respect. They only came online. They were authorized by the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863.
Right.
So then you figure, and actually out in Kansas, out in the senator out there had already started. And they had an engagement before the Emancipation Proclamation, and down in North Carolina they were jumping the gun too. But anyway, essentially they had from mid-1863 onward to prove themselves, and they proved themselves they did. I mean, they did some, they had to overcome the reluctance and doubt of white commanders at first, but Ulysses Grant seems to have been the exception. He was happy to use them, as opposed to his deputy, William Sherman. Sherman was, I just have to say, bigoted. I mean, he was a product of his culture.
Right, right.
Sometimes we forget that. It doesn't excuse his attitude and behavior, because they were potential to accomplish his mission. He did use them for as engineers, you know, labor. I mean, engineers always are out in the field, are an interesting position. They don't have guns, but they're important if you want to cross the river.
Sure.
Or get along, march along a muddy road. Sherman did use a lot of African Americans for that, but that's in a way, he used infantry units sometimes for that, though he had some engineer regiments, black engineer regiments. But that was a misuse of the infantry regiments.
There were black combat units, not only in the Civil War, but there were some African Americans who fought in the Spanish-American War, and there were all black units that fought in World War I and World War II. We don't really hear much about the ones that fought in World War I, but when their veterans came back to the United States, that was really a major step forward in the growth of what came to be known as the Civil Rights Movement, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and everything is sort of convoluted, I guess. When African Americans came home, some of them were lynched just for wearing their uniform, because a black in the uniform was an affront to a white. It just was. They wanted them to stay in their place. But, of course, that only made a lot of African Americans who had served. I mean, there were 500,000 African Americans, give or take, that served in World War I. 200,000 went overseas. 40,000 were in combat units. So, for instance, the 369th Harlem Globetrotters out of New York City, of course, might have been the best infantry regiment we sent overseas. They were certainly the first to arrive. They distinguished themselves. I mean, but the irony is they got all kinds of French awards, very few American awards.
Yeah.
Because in fact, only two African Americans earned the Medal of Honor during World War I, but they got the medal in 1990. Does that tell you something?
Sadly, not a surprise either. One of the most famous military bands, as I recall, was a military band that was all black musicians in World War One.
The 369th Regiment's band, and I'm trying to think of the commander. That's interesting. He was a first lieutenant, which was moderately rare for African Americans or officers. He actually commanded a machine gun company, but he was also the band master. And they had the band leader, the guy with the great big exaggerated baton that goes up and down.
Oh, yeah, drum major.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, I was a band guy, so I know about that stuff.
This guy was totally bodacious. I think that's the only word for him. He impressed anyone who saw him marching in front of the band. And the first lieutenant went down to Puerto Rico to hire some of his musicians. I mean, it was and that band introduced jazz to Europe for the first time.
Right.
It went over exact opposite of the lead balloon.
Yeah, it was called wildly popular. In fact, it had a bearing on American musicians African Americans, who flocked to France after the war and stayed put. Or those that were in the military after the war was over, they just stayed put because they knew they could be treated differently, and And there were civilians like Josephine Baker and so forth that did the same thing.
Hey, James Reese Europe is his name.
Right, right.
Yeah, he deserves recognition. He unfortunately died soon after returning to New York. Anyway, I must say I really enjoyed writing this book. It was a thrill.
There are so many instances here, and of course things did get better from Korea on. Toward the end of the Korean War, that's when the army was finally integrated. And from that point forward, there have always been integrated units in the U.S. military, whether it's sea or land or in the air. I would say, and reading your book reiterates that, to the credit of the newly formed Air Force, it embraced integration from the start, while the Navy, Marine Corps, and Army dragged their feet. It kind of took a former five-star general becoming president to essentially, as a commander-in-chief of U.S. military forces, to say, okay, it's time. There was a presidential proclamation in 1948. Here it is in 1954. It's in effect now. And from that point forward, right?
Yeah, it was exactly like the integration of the public school system. That was proclaimed in 54, and sadly, this is a diversion, but our schools are probably less integrated today than they were before that Supreme Court decision. But that's another story. We won't go there.
For another day. I know our time is very close to being over. Was there anything in particular that you wanted to mention that you discovered while researching this book and putting Unsung Patriots together that struck you as particularly interesting and that I didn't ask you about?
Well, yeah, I think the fate of the 24th Infantry Division during the Korean War.
Okay.
That was the last of the Buffalo Soldier regiments. Well, what happened to the Cav regiments was a disgrace. They were shipped to North Africa, and when they landed, one was converted into a bunch of stevedores, and the other was converted into an engineer regiment that worked on the airfield that the Tuskegee Airmen, which is another topic.
Right.
Very interesting. Would be using it first. And the 25th was part of the 93rd Infantry Division that was sent to the Pacific, and it was disbanded after the war. So all there's left is the 24th. They're still serving. They go off to Korea. And actually, it was interesting that they ended up on Okinawa, then were brought to Japan and were integrated into the 25th Infantry Division, which had two white divisions in addition. And for some weird reason, I mean, this was a peacetime army. We were no condition. All of the regiments had only two battalions, which is a big deal if you're in the military. You know,
right.
You have two up and one back. If you don't have one back or reserve, you're in trouble. Well, 24th did have a third battalion, but we have no idea how badly prepared we were. One division, not the one the 24th was in, two-thirds of it was captured or killed right in the first 2 months, along with the division commander. I mean,
wow.
We don't talk about that. Anyway, so the thing with the 24th was, of course, they got creamed like every other U.S. unit there by the swarms of North Korean and later Chinese communist soldiers. But when it happened to them, people would talk about, they'd start using the N-word and blame it on their race. When it happened to the rest of the army, they didn't say, oh, those whites can't fight. I mean,
yeah,
it's pretty stupid. And the last thing was, U.S. Army, having had this problem over and over again, had no replacement system for black soldiers. They insisted on segregating them, but they didn't have a regular means of replacing battlefield losses, which is a guarantee you're going to have. So the Army's first official history really wrote the 24th up as a loser outfit. But there were a lot of black soldiers that were in it, and some white soldiers who had been part of it, and some who had been next to it and seen that that wasn't really the case. I mean, so there was enough heat brought on this first version that they redid it and wrote a separate study, which is, I think, highly, highly unusual.
Yes.
But even that didn't fully exonerate the 24th. I mean, but I think, in honesty, they were just another regiment, a pretty good regiment, as a matter of fact. But they had racial tensions because some of the officers were white, some were black. They couldn't always trust each other.
Yeah.
And there was a hell of a lot of turnover, which every unit in Korea had, which turnover, that's an easy word, but that means guys dead and badly wounded.
Yeah.
Your NCOs and your officers. Anyway, I found that chapter in Korea was particularly fat. It wasn't easy because, you know, it's a lot of different facts and opinions, and you have to be fair and judgmental, but that was fascinating to me. And then you mentioned briefly how we integrated finally. It wasn't always pretty. I mean, there were fragging in Vietnam, not always racially motivated. Actually, in my 20 years, I was only 1 year in the Army. I served with a cav unit, the 1st of the 2nd Armored Cav, Robert E. Lee's cavalry regiment, by the way. Anyway, I was back. The regiment was out in the field. I was back, not the regiment, the squadron was out in the field. I was back in our base, and we got some replacements. Two good old boys from the South, an African-American from the inner city somewhere. I don't remember now. Anyway, two guys from the rednecks were harassing this black guy, and he pulled out a knife and killed one of them. So that was around 1980. So, now, to say that all the problems went away, that's not true. We still have race problems in the United States, and it would be foolish to expect that they've all gone in the military services, but they have mostly gone. And the military service academies, that's a sterling example. That part of the book I was surprised and delighted to read about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Gene, thank you for making time to talk to me today. I found the book absolutely fascinating and filled with a lot of information that was new to me. And I'm always excited about reading a book and learning new things, and I certainly did so with this one.
I mentioned, I think it's pretty unusual, I was so enthusiastic about Matt Belmont's book, Half American.
Yeah.
He has 139 reviews on Amazon. Right now, I have two I know of, and I'm probably a third's on the way. But, you know, that's how books get sold and get judged. So I hope you and some of your readers might write a review.
Okay.
On Amazon.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good book. I'm not going to say if it's better or, you know, but I think it's at least the equal of Half American because it's more comprehensive and I've got a lot of data in mind, especially the appendices. One of them's got all black Medal of Honor winners. Another one lists 400 African American admirals and general officers. That's a surprise, since the first one is started in November 1940. Anyway, I've enjoyed our interview. I won't rattle on anymore.
Well,
tell I'm jazzed by the topic.
I appreciate you making time to talk to me, Gene. The book, again, is Unsung Patriots, African Americans and America's War by Eugene DeFries-Petit. It is from Stackpole Books, which is distributed, which actually is a division of Rowan and Little, an imprint of Glo Pequo, the trade division of the Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group, Inc. You can find it online. You can go to Roman, that's Rowman.com. And I'm sure you can also just Google Stackpole Books or Unsung Patriots or Eugene Petit, and you'll find it. And look for it in your favorite local bookstores first. If you can't find it there, then by all means, ask if they can order it or go online and find it. And I think you'll find it a fascinating read. And Gene, thank you again for taking time to visit with us today on the Bookshelf.
It was my pleasure, Dave.
And thank you for your service, sir. Our guest once again for Memorial Day is Eugene DeFreeze Petit and Unsung Patriots, African Americans in America's Wars from Stackpole Books. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you, those of you who are listening or who are reading the reviews and or listening to the podcast on thebookshelf.podbeam.com. And if you are a military veteran, we thank you for your service. We can't put a price on what you did and the courage that you showed signing a check to the government with your life on it, at this blank check, and handing it over to them. We can never repay that, and we thank you most deeply. So we'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless. Every Sunday at 9:30 on FM 94.7 and at 11:30 on AM 970 and FM 96.3, here's some of the best authors in America today discussing their new books on The Bookshelf, an exclusive presentation of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTBF.